Taylor Monahan is the founder of MyCrypto, an Ethereum wallet, and today she's helping build MetaMask. As part of her job, she's become a full-time blockchain detective. She's also a character in my book, The Infinite Machine. She's the first one who alerted us to the fact that, in the past several months, a mysterious hack has taken over crypto wallets, draining $10 million worth of ETH from OGs in the space. We begin our conversation with Taylor breaking down the hack from the beginning and also updating us on the latest in this saga. Then we go over her own long history in the space. She gives risk management advice for crypto users and developers and ponders some deep questions on whether code is law and whether DeFi should really be immutable.
It's been going on for a little bit. And one of the, I guess, interesting or unique things about me is that I've been around forever and I've been building wallets forever. And so for some reason, whenever there were like these large hacks over the last few months that involved, you know, keys that were rather old, like 2016, 2015 era, a lot of times they would like get to me somehow, whether that was via like the MetaMask support team or like other investigators in the space who were trying to get to the bottom of, you know, how this seed got compromised or whatever it was. And so I started to like notice earlier this year that there did seem to be like a number of these, they were sizable hacks and they were, you know, of people that like were intelligent, they were integrated into the ecosystem, they worked in the ecosystem, et cetera, et cetera. I just thought it was kind of peculiar though. And so then fast forward to April 15th, it was a Saturday, and one of my very first hires, one of the guys that I hired like before, back in the My Ether Wallet days, in fact, calls me, which is rather unusual on a Saturday. And he goes, "Hey Taylor, my wallet's being drained right now." And I was like, "Oh no, like, oh my gosh, like your main one?" And I have a four-year-old and she's dancing around because it's sunny and it's Saturday. There's like paint and Orbeez flying everywhere. And I immediately like pull up my computer and try to like, you know, look at his address and see what's going on. And the thing about this attacker is that the way that they like steal the funds is very unusual. They actually swap, like they swap all the tokens or the NFTs within the victim's wallet before sending then the ETH out directly to like a centralized, it's a centralized exchange, but it's a non-custodial exchange. So it's like an OG shapeshift type situation. You like send your money in and then it sends Bitcoin out or whatever. And I was like looking at this pattern and I was just like, wow, that's so weird. I've only seen like a couple other attackers who've done this. You know, and again, like this guy, like I hired him in 2017. He's hung out with me for a very long time. He is what I call reasonably secure, meaning that he uses crypto, his seeds on his devices. But at the end of the day, like he's not clicking phishing links. And if he did click a phishing link, he would realize that that was the source of compromise. And so that from that incident, from trying to help one of my close friends and colleagues, you know, get to the bottom of his case, we started looking on chain. And that's when sort of this whole trail got uncovered. And at this point, I think we have confirmed like 300 victims. That are like, these are like high confidence ones. There's like a larger, broader circle of like probably victims. But it's really the hardest thing about this sort of trying to get to the bottom of this numbers wise is a lot of the people that were compromised, they had their seed phrases, their secret recovery phrases compromised. And so there's some people that we've talked to where they had like 20 or 30 addresses all drained. And so when you look on chain, you then have to like sync that with the in real life intelligence that you're gaining from talking to these people, because there might be 1,000 addresses on chain, but if everyone has 30 addresses that were drained, you know, we're dealing with a smaller victim pool.
And besides kind of the step-by-step of how it's done, you know, like swapping all the tokens for ETH and then sending it to an exchange, do we know how the hacker is gaining access to these people's seed phrases? I mean, you're saying that many of these people are pretty experienced. Like, I imagine it's some people who are just like giving away their seed phrase. So do you know how that's actually happening?
No. So that's what we're still trying to get to the bottom of. We're collecting stories, and we have, I think we have about like 50 different sort of stories, and like somewhat organized fashion have gone through, you know, the wallets they use, the devices that they use. And the most interesting thing about this, and I hesitate to say this because it's very speculative, but there are a large number of people in this group that seem to have stored their secret recovery phrases or multiple keys and secret recovery phrases all in LastPass. And obviously, there was the LastPass breach that started last August, and then it sort of information has trickled out about it through December. And so a lot of these people have sort of attributed the root cause of the compromise to the LastPass hack.
Sorry, what's LastPass?
LastPass is a password manager. It's supposed to be very, very, very secure. It's been around for a while. The issue is that a hacker got into the LastPass servers, and even though LastPass does not have your master password, the thing that like encrypts and protects your LastPass vault, even though they don't have that password, the hacker still got the vaults. And so essentially, theoretically, these hackers now have everyone's vaults, and they can, like, if they can brute force or guess your master password, then they can get all of your passwords and any other information that's inside that LastPass vault. And so that's what there are a decent number of people who think that the hackers who hacked LastPass then have gone in and hacked, you know, their individual keys from the LastPass breach. I'm less confident about that simply because a lot of the LastPass vaults had very, very strong passwords. And it would surprise me to learn that, you know, a 24-character super random password was brute forced. I think that if I had to guess right now, I think that what's happening is that there's some either like data leak, or there's some old malware, or something has happened where an attacker is like going back through some pile of data and extracting the seeds and the keys that they can from it. But we will see how it turns out. It's so hard to figure out.
So crazy. And what's the, like, the most recent amount that you have of ETH that's been drained?
So I think the ETH number is about the same. What we have learned, though, is that there's a sizable amount of people who have had coins on other chains. So there's Bitcoin, there's Litecoin, there's Doge, there's Tezos, Polkadot. Like, I mean, it's basically every chain. It's crazy. I'll post some numbers today, and then I'll link it for you and your listeners so that we can have some better numbers that are more up to date. But it's really hard to wrap my head around it. You know what I mean? Like, just the sprawling nature of it.
What kind of information are you able to gain from from your research? Like, is about the hacker. Like, do you think if this is one individual person, a group, a country? I don't know. Like, is there anything we can discern from kind of what's happening?
So I think that it's probably some sort of group. The reason for that is some of the investigations that have been done have obtained like the server logs from various services that the hackers were using. And those, the information that gets returned, like sometimes you can get some IP addresses, sometimes you can get like the user agent for the browser that the attacker is using and that kind of stuff. And so I think it's probably a group just because you see sort of distinct little fingerprints depending on like the, you know, day to day it'll change, but it'll be the same, like same IP, but different user agents, and then this different user agent, same IP, going back and forth. There's some that at least one of the guys in the group, I guess, is using a Mac, which is fabulously interesting. Don't usually see that. And the other reason I think it's a group is like there's just like the speed and efficiency with which they do it. And then the sort of the time cycles that you see indicate that it's some sort of like organized effort. And so what I mean by that is if you look at like a single guy who hacks a protocol or something, his timeline will be all over the map. They don't sleep a regular schedule. They'll take days off in between. They might go on vacation, those sorts of things. And you can kind of see it when you map it out over time. These wallet drains seem to be sort of operating on a more regular schedule. They'll go for like, they'll drain wallets and sort of like move the funds from point A to point B, like for 9 hours, 10 hours, that sort of stuff. And it's so regular that at this point I would be surprised if it was just one very dedicated dude.
Wow. So this looks like this kind of just like very organized, you know, operation of hackers doing this.
Yeah. And that's what generally it's like, not just with crypto hacks and stuff, but generally with the malware groups, the phishing groups, the ransomware groups we're seeing lately, is they are far more organized and it's groups of people. And then you also increasingly we're seeing this sort of separation between the creators of the software that hacks the things or phishes the people. There'll be like a team that's developing the software or the malware or the ransomware or whatever it is. But the ones that are actually going out and like getting it into the wild and like pushing it to victims, those are what they call them like affiliates. And it's like a real business almost.
Oh God, that's horrible. Hackers getting specialized.
Yes.
How likely do you think it is that they get away with it?
I think it'll come down to, we have to figure out sort of the root source of it. And then once we sort of collect that information, we'll go back to some of the law enforcement agents that are working it already on some of the bigger cases and try to put all the information together. Obviously, if they're located in the US or most of the West, there's like a pretty good chance that they'll be caught pretty quickly. If they are in like Russia, Ukraine, if it's a group operating out of those, then it's a whole different situation.
Before we go further in hack territory, I'd love to hear your backstory. I mean, you've mentioned how long you've been in the space, that you were in MyCrypto before, now in MetaMask. You're just such an OG. So I would love to get your backstory on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess I got into the space right before Mt. Gox collapsed, which was basically like 100 centuries ago. I got some Bitcoin. It was not on Mt. Gox, so I did not lose the Bitcoin, but I wasn't super like deep in the ecosystem at that point. I was just sort of part of it and watching, and you know, I found it very interesting. And then fast forward, I got into Ethereum during the pre-sale using some of the Bitcoin that I had acquired previously. And then Ethereum launched. And it turns out that there was no way to send your Ether from one place to another when Ethereum launched, unless you wanted to use command line. And so that is sort of my origin story, was I personally was not going to send all my Ether via command line. And so me and my original co-founder, Kosala, we sat down and we created a very simple interface that just allowed Taylor to do the things with the buttons. And we shared it with some friends. We put it on Reddit. And then from there, it was very, very organic. Like, people would ask for features. We were part of the ecosystem. We had things that we wanted to do. I got involved in the DAO. That was super exciting. The people were all like super, super nice. Then the DAO got hacked. And so we had to like figure out how to fix that mess. And yeah, I've just sort of like, I guess, let the just gone from like one major event and like one problem that needed like my unique expertise to the next. I've been building wallets this whole time, but it's like the thing that I actually focus on is, you know, trying to make this space more accessible, trying to help people like both be in control of their money and their assets. And today, like, it's their identity at this point. It's getting crazy. But also, like, what does that mean? Like, we want to empower people, but in order to empower people, it's not just like, you know, throw the keys at them and like say good luck. Like, we have to actually understand where people are failing and where they're struggling, understand the assumptions that they're having, and then build products that are actually going to, you know, enable them and empower them to safely and successfully hold their stuff, and then also interact with the world, right? Like, we don't want to just like lock away the key and never use it. The whole point of this stuff is so that we can like interact with people and improve coordination between groups. And yeah, it's probably one of the hardest things, certainly the hardest thing I've ever done. I think it's probably one of the hardest problems, like, just generally speaking, in this world right now.
Yeah, for crypto, yeah, just improving accessibility and making the space more safe for regular users and for everyone. So in this time, and it's funny that, or I don't know if funny is the word, but like you were involved in the original Ethereum hack and have been just like tracking all of this, you know, all of these exploits since Ethereum started, the original hack being the DAO hack. In that time, how have things changed? Like, are attacks getting more sophisticated? Is code getting better? Like, have you seen the space get safer? Or, because from kind of the data doesn't seem that way, right? It's like more and more money is getting hacked, but I'm not sure if that's just because there's more interest in this space and just like mm-hmm. there's a bigger honeypot attracting more hackers. Or is that because it's just very hard problem to solve and it's just, you know, it's hard to make it safer? What have you seen?
I think there's a couple unique things about this space that make it seem like the hacking is a bigger problem than it actually is. This is not to say that it's not a problem. Like, it definitely is a problem. But I think that specifically when people like try to compare crypto hacks to like traditional finance or non-crypto even, I think people are very quick to assume that like there's more hacks and there's more loss within the crypto space than elsewhere. And I think the reason for that is that, one, it's like crypto is actually transparent. So we actually know exactly how much is being hacked and we can go track it and get those numbers. And then the other thing is that it's very much talked about. And I think that even in the cases where you have large scale scams around like Zelle, QuickPay and Cash App and like all these things, it's really not talked about at all. You know, and like the crypto ecosystem, we collaborate a lot on trying to solve the hacks, but we also just like, we analyze them. There's databases of them. We count them. We make graphs of them. I do think that from like looking at crypto's history from say like the DAO to today, there's definitely like the numbers are definitely bigger, but so is all of crypto. I don't think that relatively speaking, it's like if you were to adjust the data to you know, account for the growth that the ecosystem has seen in both like user numbers, but also like value wise, I think that we're probably, there's probably like less loss, relatively speaking. The other thing that's changed is that we're just starting to see the beginnings of like, people saying like, no, you can't hack me. Like, yes, you just hacked me, but like, no, you can't. And it's interesting because I think we did this, like, we did the DAO, we responded that with a hard fork, which was very controversial. But what that was like, it was a messy ad hoc way to give the people that had lost money a path to recovery. From that point, from like, yeah, the hard fork on, there was a very long period of time where people really did not want to talk about the fact that like if your money got hacked, if something got hacked, like that was it. That was the end. There was nothing you could do. Nobody tried to stop the hackers. Nobody tried to like dox the hackers. Nobody tried to like force the centralized entities to like stop the hackers. Most of the money that was like being stolen by, you know, anything from like little script kiddies on the street to like North Korean hackers would just run around the blockchain and then go into the centralized exchange through these money laundering networks and then out into the real world. Today, I think it's like last couple of years, we're actually starting to see a shift. Like we're actually starting to see a lot more of the stolen assets being frozen, with like the Euler hack lately, like is a good example of a team that said, we are going to sit down and do everything that we possibly can to get this money back, whatever that takes. And they were successful at it. And that, I think that's probably one of the things that excites me the most about this. Like we're getting better at stopping the stolen funds. We're getting better at these creative ways, like the MEV bots that front run the hackers and then return the money. I think that's, yeah, it'll be interesting to see because ultimately we do need to have some sort of like risk or pressure on the hackers and the attackers. Otherwise, they're just going to keep running rampant. And that's, in my opinion, not acceptable.
No, that's a really big and interesting development and change over the years. I think you're right. We have seen that shift in teams and projects that they're realizing that they can fight back. And it's good to see that third parties are helping with that. So yeah, centralized exchanges, freezing funds. And I think now regulatory agencies are more knowledgeable about crypto and they, I think they can step in faster when things happen. And I think maybe the industry is more established that, you know, people feel comfortable going to a law enforcement when there is a hack. I think maybe before, victims felt like, oh, we're in this fringe thing, crypto, like we can't go to like authorities because it is what it is, you know, not your keys, not your crypto or whatever, you know, law, code is law and whatever, like there's nothing we can do about it. But now there's this feeling of, okay, now we can actually fight back.
I think that mentality, that change both internal to the ecosystem, like realizing like, wait, there are things that people have done. Like that is so huge and so exciting because the thing that people don't often realize is like, the blockchain is all public. Like you can see every transaction. It's actually a terrible way to launder money. A lot of the regulations that are in place in traditional finance are actually trying to solve the problem of the opacity of the system, right? So like if you have an attacker in the traditional world who wants to launder money, like they just bank hop like wherever they want because you can't see it. You can't see it. You have to get the privileged information from the financial institutions in order to follow the money. Whereas on the blockchain, like literally I can follow the money. Like you can literally watch it. And that's like, I don't know. It's pretty cool. It's pretty empowering. There's obviously like there's still the centralized institutions that sort of like bridge the gap. But I think that they are getting better at being able to like realize like, no, these funds are stolen. You know, like it doesn't matter if the if the attacker is using like a compromised exchange account or like what the KYC information on the exchange account is, like the funds are stolen, right? Like we can see the money is stolen. And so, yeah, when they freeze that and then you know, prevent it from going on until, like, you know, a more thorough investigation can be carried out. I think that's a huge change that's, you know, only going to get better with more experience and as people are successful at this kind of stuff.
Meet Stater Labs, the non-custodial, multi-chain liquid staking platform that's aiming to transform the liquid staking landscape. With over 120 million in assets staked and more than 40,000 users across six chains, Stater is partnered with 40-plus top DeFi protocols like Aave and Balancer. Gear up for the launch of ETHX, Stater's liquid staking token on Ethereum. With a unique multi-pool architecture and tokenomics, ETHX empowers stakers everywhere with as little as 4 ETH to run a node and earn 35% more than solo staking. The best part? Stater is committed to keeping their fees low and accessible to users, charging only 10% of staking rewards, so you don't have to choose between cost and decentralization. Sign up for their ETHX Alpha list today and be the first to know about 1 million in DeFi rewards. Just wanted to drop a bit of context. So Chainalysis does these annual reports on money that's stolen in crypto. And they said that 2022 was the biggest year ever for crypto hacking. So $4 billion was stolen, and that's up from $3.3 billion in 2021. So just, you know, putting in context, like, actually how much money is being stolen. So, you know, obviously really positive developments with crypto fighting back, but still a lot to do. And I wanted to go to this topic of, you know, what I mentioned, code is law, which I think used to be this argument that was made, I think maybe more so in, you know, in the past, but I still see it, and it's, you know, this argument that developers put this code out there, it's supposed to be immutable and permissionless. Hackers are just figuring out a way to use that code in a way that benefits them. So, you know, it is what it is. They're able to figure it out, and it's kind of your fault because you didn't know better, or like your code wasn't good enough. What do you think about that?
Oh, I hate it. I think it's absurd. I think it's, I've always hated it. I think that it is I think it stems from like the combination of like the very libertarian crypto anarchist roots of this ecosystem combined with just like the sheer number of engineer brains. And like, I love engineers and I love the way that they can like solve problems and I love how their brains work. But like, that's not how the world works. Like, code is not law. Law is law. And like, law is, or should be, you know, defined by people in society. And if something is wrong, like, theft is bad, right? Like, if I steal your stuff, it's bad. If it's allowed to carry on, meaning that like if I steal your stuff and then I can just walk around and there's no harm that comes to me, there's no punishment, like, you know, I stole your stuff and that's like, that's the way the world works. What ends up happening is that I am now incentivized and other people are now incentivized to steal. And you are actually like, you have created this organization, you've like added value to this world, you've received money in return for adding value to this world, right? But since I stole that from you, you have been like decentivized from doing that. And the other people in society are gonna look at you and be like, okay, so I could go and I could work really hard and try to have a positive impact on the world around me and get paid for that. But you know what? Actually, it turns out that like I might just have all my stuff stolen. So maybe I'll just be a thief too. And this is why, this is why theft is bad. It's bad for people. It's bad for society. And if we let thieves, like, you know, sort of, if there's no harm that comes to thieves, like socially, legally, financially, like anything, if there's no risk, society tends to degrade pretty quickly. And I think that we should I'm not a fan of like the, you know, bring in the big bad law enforcement and like, you know, that sort of path. But I also think that there's a huge area in between letting hackers and thieves like just run around willy nilly and do whatever they want. And like, you know, some just, yeah, like authoritarian state, like there's a lot of room in the middle there where we can get creative and, you know, find a good balance that allows people to be empowered and have control of their stuff while also not allowing thieves to run our world.
Yeah, I think, you know, with that argument doesn't consider the fact that there's an intention when developers write that code. So, okay, maybe they made a mistake and it could be exploited, but, you know, when you create a lending protocol, it's meant to do things a certain way. If a hacker figures out, you know, how to do things differently, then it's very clear that that wasn't the intention, even though, you know, the code is there. So there is at least that kind of, you know, argument you can make against the thief. Like, yeah, you use the code how you could use it, but no, not how it should be used. Along kind of this reasoning, there's also this kind of like tricky question in DeFi on, and this goes also back to the DAO. Like, if developers have the power to, you know, go into God mode and turn things off or update, like single-handedly update a protocol to recover funds, should they do it? I mean, again, this also goes in line with this is supposed to be like permissionless, autonomous, and so on. DeFi is not supposed to work that way, right? Like, we're not supposed to have a group of people making unilateral decisions. Like, it's all supposed to be smart contract based. But in the case of there being a theft and like users being affected, do you think it's something that they should do?
It's a really tricky area because a lot of what is sort of communicated about certain DeFi protocols, a lot of what people think of their own DeFi protocols, if they're like on a team or even the creator of one, is not necessarily in line with how things are today. And so while they're like optimistically hopeful that in the future it will be this completely permissionless thing or run by governance or whatever it is, the reality is a lot of times today, there's like a single admin key that can do whatever, can upgrade the contracts, can, you know, with like one person, or a more ideal situation is a multi-sig. But like, yeah, a lot of times it's one person. So in my opinion, if you give yourself God mode, right, if you've created this thing and you give yourself God mode, and something happens where you are, you're in a position to recover funds for like the rightful owner, I think you probably should. And if you don't want to be in that position, then I think you should probably think more carefully about giving yourself God mode in the first place. But I think that like both giving yourself that power without taking responsibility for that power is like you can't have your cake and eat it too. Like you have to take responsibility for your creations, you know. And I would never tell a protocol like you should give yourself the power. It's more so the fact that like if you have and you end up with a bunch of hacker funds, I'm probably going to be the first one to come up to you and tell you that hey, you can upgrade this contract and make users whole and give them their funds that are rightfully theirs that they worked hard for, and you should probably do that.
So with all this, you know, like with all the hacks happening and maybe kind of the problems of accessibility, which, you know, you and so many other, you know, brilliant people are working towards, but we're not there yet. Do you think that, would you advocate for crypto to go mainstream now? Do you think is the space ready for just like, you know, billions of people to come and trust it, like the technology with their, all of their funds?
No, we have so much work to do. I think that for people that get into the space, you know, with some understanding of, you know, the risks and are having fun with it, let's go, you know, like I, the more the merrier. At the same time, I think just blindly like telling people like, this is the future, this is the magical internet money, come, and not informing them of the risks and the reality that, that there are a lot of scammers, there's a lot of fishers, there's a lot of hackers. There's a lot of like just holding crypto, like you're going to be targeted more than not holding crypto right now. And it's just very unfamiliar. There's like a learning curve. So I don't think that we should just be running for mass adoption, but I do think that we are generally like on the right path where things are getting better. There are a lot of new technologies in the works that will help make things safer. And ultimately, like it's going to be this combination of like all the different like product choices, all the different technologies, all the different brains working together that ultimately get us to a point where, you know, it can, you can have like the different solutions for different types of people. You can on ramp like slowly and surely. You can find things that work for you depending on your needs, right? Like someone like Snowden is in a different boat than someone who just wants to like, hold a fun NFT because they went to an event or something, right? And they don't need the same, you know, necessarily need to train the random NFT holder about like, you know, perfect security and perfect privacy. But you do want to have the ability for someone who needs that perfect security and privacy to have it.
Crazy to hear someone in crypto say, no, we're not ready for mainstream.
I spend a lot of time with users and like I consume more information around the loss. Like I talk to more people who have had a bad experience with crypto than most. So I might be slightly biased, but like it's just the sheer number of ways that you can lose your crypto, right? Like there's accidents that happen. You can make a mistake. You can be like tricked into it. So like the most of the phishing these days is not like stealing your seed phrase. It's tricking you into taking an action you think that you want to do, but you don't want to do. And then it goes all the way towards like, yeah, the malware, the hacks, the very sophisticated protocol hacks. There's just so much, and they're creative. Like hackers and scammers are incentivized to be very, very creative, and we need to be more creative than them on the solutions to protect people.
So that's perfect segue to, I wanted to ask you about what advice do you give crypto users to prevent being hacked?
Yeah, so I used to have a list of like very tangible like steps you could take security-wise, and some of it still applies. Like I definitely recommend if you're in the space to like get a hardware wallet and use your hardware wallet. Ledger is a great choice. Trezor is a great choice. I'm a big fan of the Grid Plus. The Lattice, it has a big screen. I like it. I feel fancy. The other thing I think that is increasingly helpful though, especially as the scams and the hacks and stuff get more diverse, is just don't keep all of your crypto in like a single bucket. So if you have like your secret recovery phrase or your MetaMask or whatever, like that's fine. Use that and use that for all of your day-to-day stuff that you want, but don't keep all of your funds on it, please. And at this point, I would say that, you know, if you've been in the space for a while, you know, and you want to, like, let's say you have a seed phrase from 2017 that, you know, you haven't really touched that much, but you probably have put it on a computer at some point. Maybe don't migrate the full mass of that from like one seed to a new seed. Maybe split in half. Maybe split it in thirds. You know, I think everyone's situation is obviously different, but The one thing that, like, in talking specifically to the people who have been in the space who got hacked, most of them are generally fine, even if they had like 20 accounts hacked, because they had like a nest egg that wasn't hacked because it was carved into titanium and like hidden under the bed or whatever, right? Very paranoid stuff. But that you don't have to go, you don't have to go that far to have the same benefits, right? Like you can just separate out and put these eggs in this basket and these eggs in this basket. And then if something bad happens, you don't want the person to be able to grab both. So keep them separate. Hardware wallets, paper is good. It's hard to have paper. And then the other advice I have that I think that we're going to have to figure out a good, we're going to have to figure out a product to help with this, but like an easy way to like literally migrate all your funds or split your funds or something, I think is like necessary at this point. I'm surprised that there's not a better tool out there, but it is, you know, once you've been in the space and you have your positions and you have your tokens and you have things on four different L2s, just the idea of like migrating to a fresh seed is very overwhelming. And that's why, you know, some of these people whose seeds are getting, you know, from 2017 are getting compromised. A lot of them are saying, yeah, I knew I should have migrated. I knew that that seed had been on like four different computers and two phones over the years. But nothing bad had happened yet. And I'm pretty secure. And so I didn't take the time to do that tedious and annoying task. And I definitely understand it. I had to migrate some of my funds after helping my friend. I had to go migrate a whole bunch of myself because I got scared, you know, and that was like the inspiration to like not be lazy anymore.
I mean, it's a pain, but it's a bigger pain to get your funds stolen. So better to follow Tay's advice here. For devs, when they're building their protocols, like any advice on how to make it safer or easier to use at least?
So I think definitely learn from the past hacks. At this point, there are so many helpful like write-ups and postmortems and databases of all the past hacks. So if you're building a lending protocol, if you're building a whatever it is, please take some time to understand. This year, it's been 3 years of DeFi like stuff, right? Like since DeFi summer. Learn from the experiences of others so that you don't make the same mistakes. There have been a lot of mistakes. You can learn so much. And then I think you should think carefully about, like when we talk about system design, a lot of the times like these DeFi protocols, they sort of limit it to their own protocol and their users and the things internal to their system. And then maybe they think about the oracles or whatever that are coming in. But what's really, I think, probably one of the most interesting developments in the last year and a half or so is if you actually look at the system as a whole and you include Ethereum and you include like the existence of like arbitrage bots and MEV bots, there are probably some really creative things that a lot of these protocols could do where if they are hacked, there is like a better chance that a like MEV bot front runs the hacker, right? And there's a lot of like interesting things with incentives and the design of things where, again, like I'm not one of those big engineer brains, but like I'm certain that there's a way to use incentives to make it so that like, you know, if something bad happens, you know, there's a better chance that, you know, the hacker gets front run or maybe there's, you know, some freeze that happens so that like only a portion of the funds are stolen, those sorts of things. I really wish that we saw more creativity around that.
What about having like a white hack fund or like reward pool or something, you know, so that at least it's profitable for people who are snooping around to, you know, to help the team rather than steal from it?
I think it's if you're going to be building in the space and like having like hold it, if you're going to have access to any amount of other people's money, it's I would say it's mandatory that you have like a public sort of like a security philosophy or, you know, a thing that outlines like, here's how you report bugs or vulnerabilities or things. Here's like how you do so anonymously. And here's what happens. Like if you white hat this, here's the bounty that you're allowed to keep. And here's the process that you need to, you need to undergo in order to be a legitimate white hat, not like a half white, half gray, maybe black.
It's like, I was a black hat, but then I got dogs, so I turned into a white hat.
What? Exactly. So if teens like are out there and they're, you know, you should definitely incentivize people to report the bug to you before they hack it. But you should realize that, you know, given the, I'll just say, given the nature of the space and the characters in it, that may not be enough. And so, like, if you do have someone that actually hacks you, you should consider, you know, incentivizing them to return the funds, you know, because some of them are, they lack impulse control. So they're not attracted by the disclose responsibly bounty, but like the second they hack in and get the money, they are suddenly like, ooh, okay, now I'll go. And then obviously, yeah, if they get doxxed, they'll usually that's a pretty good incentive. That inverse incentive is a good one.
On TV, you see, like, you don't negotiate with terrorists. Like, that's, I don't know. It's like, what do you usually hear? It looks like negotiating with hackers has yielded good results. Like, a lot of people have been able to get money back that way. I mean, do you think it's a good practice to do that?
I think that over time, as, you know, the system and security procedures and, like, information and risk controls and stuff, like, as the ecosystem in general matures more, I think that we'll probably at some point get to a state where, like, no, you should not negotiate. Like, it's more harm than good. At this point, though, it's just so fresh. A lot of the teams, not all of them, but a lot of the teams that got hacked are, it's very hard to tell what's a black hat, what's a gray hat, what's a white hat, what's a rug, what's not a rug. There's a lot of gray areas. And so for now, I think that, I think that the negotiations and the bounties and that kind of stuff, I think it's probably like a net win over the alternative. But yeah, long term, ultimately, a better way of going about things would be to have, like, you know, just more robust, like, systems and structures where it's, you're a legit project because you've done all of these things and you've worked hard to secure your code base. You're not a white hat if you hack something. That's how it should be, ideally. But until we get there, and, you know, it takes time. I think that, you know, we're rebuilding huge swaths of the world in, like, this weird casino Ponzi-esque way. It's just, we'll get there. But in the meantime, we're there's some things that, you know, you can't just like pick from, you know, something that's been built up over time in the traditional world and like put it on the stuff here, given the situation.
As we get there, obviously wallets are a huge part on, you know, how we build a better financial system and infrastructure for this Web3 new internet and so on. Like you said before, you've been building wallets almost since this beginning of crypto, or at least of Ethereum. So, really curious to hear what's the latest there. Like, what's exciting to you right now in wallets?
Yeah, so I think that, I don't know if you've already had someone on to talk about like account abstraction and all of the technical details around that, but I think that's probably like what's most top of mind for people in wallets at this point. If you haven't had someone, I'll find someone for you who can like really dive into
it. Awesome. Yeah, no, I haven't yet.
Oh yeah, it's there's better people to talk about it than me, so I'll let them do it. But it's really, really interesting how they've approached it. And I'll talk just broadly though, like kind of big swaths about like what the whole point of account abstraction is. So essentially, right now you have your wallet and that has usually your secret recovery phrase in it or another form of your private key. And that private key basically controls everything. It has full control over everything in it. That's your NFTs. That's your soulbound NFTs. It's your tokens. It's across all the different blockchains. Like, it's crazy. If your secret recovery phrase is stolen, then it's game over. Then the attacker and you both have full control over anything in that wallet and anything that will ever be in the wallet, anything that was in the wallet, like, you know, and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, we just talked about a lot of ways that you can like do things at, like post it, but like at the core of like the wallet's job and the private key, there's nothing you can actually do about the private key. Like, it's still compromised. So the point of account abstraction, or the thing that excites me most about wallets right now, is ideally there shouldn't be like one piece of information that has so much control. There should be like a secret, and there should be levels of like authorization. There should be different like, you know, controls and restrictions. Like for most of my wallets, I think that like I would be very happy to say like, I, you know, some time needs to pass, or I need to have another signer, or hey, like if it's these crappy tokens that are for fun, yeah, like I can do anything with those on any site, but like my ape, like that is my pride and joy. That no, like that needs something else. I need to sign a message on my computer and my phone, or I need to get my friend to approve it or something, right? And so there's all these different ways of basically like granting authority over distinct pieces of your the things that you hold in your identity. And then the other key piece of that is like revoking that authority. So in the case where something is compromised or I do something bad, I want to be able to say like, no more. Like, I revoke that permission. You cannot do that anymore. And I think that is pretty complex. There's technical challenges. There's protocol level changes. There's wallet changes. There's product things. Like, it's huge. But ultimately, that will single-handedly, like, all of those improvements over time at all the different layers will make the space and people's control just infinitely better than what it is now.
Super interesting. I was actually at ETH Denver. I was moderating a panel with one of the guys from the Ethereum Foundation when they made the announcement that the EIP for account abstraction had been approved. And kind of heard about it then. And I think there's like so many different layers of how user experience can be improved with this. Definitely worth an entire show on its own, but it's sounds like this major milestone that just happened to make things easier and safer for users at the wallet level or at the account level. And then to wrap up, interested to hear your perspective on this, because we're talking about all these, you know, behavior changes that people need to have in order to use crypto, like learning seed phrases and, you know, dealing with accounts and wallets and all these, you know, different like foreign things. Do you think that when crypto does become mainstream, do you think that it'll be by getting this a new generation of users to learn these new behaviors? Like just learn, okay, like now I need to be responsible for my assets. Like, I'm not trusting a third party with this. Like, these are all the different things that I need to do. Just like, you know, interact with the internet in a different way to adjust for crypto. Or is it the other way around? And does crypto need to adapt to the way that users already do things?
So I think it's both. I think there's a lot of people who would say that like crypto needs to adapt and like it should be as easy as PayPal or as easy as Venmo or whatever it is. And I'm actually not in that camp and haven't been for a while, simply because it's not very interesting to rebuild PayPal or Venmo. And you know, the way that they've sort of that user experience and the control the user has, it's, you know, it's evolved over time. But at the end of the day, like I'm not here to build something where someone else has full control and can like press the stop button and can like do these things. I think that it's like fundamentally important that people, at the end of the day, people have control over their wallet, and like no one else can, no one else can like just universally, unilaterally control it. That said, I apply that not to like just a centralized financial institution that we're familiar with. I also apply it to like a scammer or a hacker, right? Like nobody should be able to get unilateral access or control over your identity and your digital assets. And so I do think that we need to understand how that's happening. We need to really deeply understand people's experience. And yeah, there's going to be some cases where people are going to evolve to understand, you know, how these things work, and why, you know, there's new words and there's new concepts and that kind of stuff. But in other cases, you know, we can't just put it all on the user. We can't just say like, okay, like, you know, you figure it out. No, like there's a lot that technology can do to help users without, you know, taking that control away from them. There's a lot that we can do to like detect that, say, a bad thing is probably going to be happening. There's a lot of things we can do to say like, yeah, the user probably doesn't want to do this. Like the user probably doesn't want to send all of their apes out at once. Like it's a very rare thing. And so in that circumstance, you know, the wallet should probably tell the user like, hey, are you sure? Like, are you really sure? And then, yeah, if the user like, you know, confirms it and is like, yeah, I'm really sure. Like I clicked it on both my computer and my phone. I'm not a hacker and I actually want to do this. Then yeah, ultimately the user's in full control. And that's what I, like when I talk about like the big gray area in between the two things, that's what I talk about is like, you know, there's a lot of ways that you can find creative solutions to, you know, the most common problems without taking the control away from the user or like putting it in the hands of a centralized entity. And there's a lot of ways that you can help the user make better and more informed choices about the actions that they're taking without, you know, both without like imposing upon them, but also without like giving them a random string of characters and being like, good luck. And then being like, oh, you didn't realize that that was going to send all of your NFTs away. Sorry, you should have learned. Sorry. You know what I mean? Like, it's absurd. It's absurd. So, yeah, we'll have to get better. There's a lot of work that we can do. I think, like, at this point in time, there's probably more things that wallets and products in the space should be doing to help the user understand the actions that they're taking or potentially taking and help protect them. But ultimately, yeah, it's going to be different and people are going to have to learn.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's like, there will definitely need to be a behavior change and a paradigm shift for using crypto, but crypto needs to help make that transition better. And yeah, right now it's, you know, we're getting there, but not there yet. Taylor, it was so great having you on the podcast. I love chatting with you. So yeah, thanks for taking the time. Also, it's, you know, I think kind of it's very neat what you do. I mean, besides kind of being this blockchain sleuth, just like saying things like they are and just like calling out BS. Yeah, I just like always appreciate that about you. So thanks for everything. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I love everything that you've been doing, and keep it up.